Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 460 with my guest, Dr. Perry Helkitis. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I'm not a therapist. It's not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The social media handles you can follow me at are at MentalPod, and MentalPod.com is the website. Go to the website, fill out some surveys. Maybe we'll read your survey on the air. There's also a forum there. You can support the show through the website, all kinds of good stuff. I am feeling the effects of the shortened days, pretty much every fall that rolls around, especially in November after daylight savings time, this depression creeps in, and it's not anything earth-shattering or paralyzing. It's just a feeling of being numb, and most of the things that I enjoy, just I don't quite enjoy them as much. I mean, I had a good day yesterday, but today is kind of a classic fall depression day. I really have a hard time getting any work done, and today's episode is, outside the interview, is just going to be one survey in front of it and one survey behind it, and I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to be a people pleaser. That's where I'm at. I know I'll come out the other side of this. I always do. It just kind of sucks when I'm in it because everything feels like it's lifting weights. So there you have it. Our sponsor for today is BetterHelp.com. If you have never tried online counseling, I really, really recommend BetterHelp.com. I love my therapist, and I love sitting down every Monday afternoon. We do a video chat, and she helps me so, so much. She's helped me work through so many issues over the last couple of years, and I feel totally safe in her care, would you call that? Under her satellite? What would the term be? But she's awesome. So if you want to know more, go to betterhelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the /mental part so that they know you came from this podcast. Then fill out a questionnaire and they'll match you up with a BetterHelp.com counselor so you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's right for you. You need to be over 18. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care. and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Mad Woman in the Attic. And she writes, when I was 12, my mom began a sexual relationship with my former brother-in-law. I learned about it, not being told, but by observing their flirtatious and overtly sexual behavior towards each other. The relationship was eventually brought to light when another family member walked in on them making out in the bathroom. If you're going to have sex with your daughter's husband, you got to do it in the bathroom. That's the only classy place to do it. When my sister found out, she was understandably enraged. It's a long story, and this is stating the obvious, but she and my mom have had a complicated relationship. And ever since my sister was in college, her life has been total chaos. Drugs, alcohol, having one baby after another, and multiple husbands. Meanwhile, my mom continued seeing my sister's former first husband and eventually marrying him. They are still married to this day, 30 years later. I was the only kid left at home when it all started, so I got to observe my mom's developing romance with my former brother-in-law firsthand. To add to the complexity, did I mention that my sister and this ex have a child together? That's right, my mom is stepmother to her grandson. Believe it or not, I'm close to my mom. Despite some egregious behavior, she's been a wonderful and supportive mother in many respects. She's had this way of really seeing me. My relationship with her is not contentious as the way hers has been with my sister. I try to hold together all the good and the bad in a way that doesn't make my head explode. Anyway, flash forward to the present day. I give my mom a call to check in. We talk about how she's planning to attend my nephew's graduation in another part of the country next month. She mentions that my sister, my nephew's mother, plans to attend as well. My mom sighs. I just don't understand her and the choices she makes in life. True to form, my sister, still married to her fourth husband, recently started having an affair with her boss. She moved in with the guy and took her young daughter with her. It turns out she's bringing the boss with her on the trip to the graduation. It's inappropriate, my mom says. Why does she have to bring him along and put her kids through that?
Nobody's cool and everyone's scared. And we're just all in this together.
There was no joy.
Overeating.
Apathy doesn't leave any marks.
Numbing out.
Physically.
I wish that I was a girl.
Panic attacks were so violent.
Rudderless. They were mistaken for seizures.
Shock coke in my neck.
The TV was talking to me.
Romantically, I am becoming the woman that I feared.
He said, there's going to be a second hunger strike.
Nothing's real.
And I'm going to die.
Sometimes I just go, hey, I can't deal.
Just beyond broken.
I'm one out.
You have to like fantasize about the person I'm with.
I'm going to stop it.
Fucking someone else.
It's okay to be different.
That I don't want to die is a miracle.
To be weird.
I'm so happy to be here.
I'm going to help you one day. People are going to love you for that.
It takes a lot of work to heal.
It's hard being a weird kid.
Sometimes you don't realize how fucked up something was until you feel the opposite of it.
You will just never see what you're not looking for.
I didn't know how to break up with him, so I just transferred schools.
I'm here with Dr. Perry Helkitis, I'm pronouncing that correctly?
Correct.
You're a doctor and you have so many degrees. I'm not, there should be a whole Jeopardy show just on people guessing how many degrees you have. Your areas of expertise are psychology, public health, LGBTQ issues,
right,
the history of LGBTQ movements, the intersection of those things. What a benefit to society somebody like you is to be able to pull all of these important things and to bring them together and look at them through a single lens. So I'm excited to talk to you, especially you've lived in New York City since 1981, 80?
I've lived in New York City my whole life.
Oh, your whole life.
Since 1963.
Oh, you were in Queens before that.
Yeah, I grew up in the city. My parents immigrated to New York from Greece in the 1950s, and I've been there my whole life.
Okay. And I'm just going to move your mic over just a tiny bit.
Okay.
There we go. I have always been interested in Stonewall, what New York was like in the 80s, when, you know, the whole AIDS crisis exploded and our government was doing nothing,
mm-hmm.
how it affected the artistic community, how it affected individual people, the effect on people's psyches, all of that. So, go.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I actually just recently wrote an editorial for the American Journal of Public Health tracing the Stonewall riots to the AIDS epidemic, to the way we're dealing with LGBTQ issues nowadays, right? And I, you know, the 80s were a very difficult time. There's no doubt about it. There was a lot of death. There was a lot of loss.
And for the people who aren't familiar with Stonewall, if you could kind of set the scene.
June 28th, 1969, New York City, the Stonewall riots, the beginning of the LGBTQ rights movement. Prior to that time, people throughout the country, in New York and other parts of the country, were arrested for even congregating. They were not allowed to socialize together. So there were all these hidden clubs, and, you know, men would go to dance with men and women would go to dance with women. And, you know, you couldn't openly love who you wanted to love. It was, being a gay person was considered a psychopathology until 1974.
What was the discussion like among people who were openly gay between each other about this being pathologized as a mental disorder? Did a lot of people believe it and hate themselves as a result?
Well, I think a lot of people believe it now, actually, still. I think that, you know, that what permeates our society even to this day when we think about conversion therapy and, you know, other forms of, like, illegal and unethical treatments is that people have internalized this idea that something is not normal about being a gay person, right? And so in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1940s and the 1930s, people suppressed their identity. They suppressed their sexuality. Do I think that some people thought it was an illness? Of course they did, and they didn't act upon it. Those who did act upon it, like, you know, Billy Haynes, for example, who was this very famous actor from the 1920s, like a number one actor in our country, you know, chose to live his life openly, right, and as a gay man, and was completely ostracized from Hollywood. So if anybody wanted
to... Probably why I've never heard of him.
Right. And he was, you know, in the era of Clark Gable, you know, this amazing, talented, I think the number one matinee attraction in 1930, and, you know, completely erased from the history books because he chose to be with his partner and have his life, and he clearly didn't think being a gay man was a problem. But, you know, for a lot of people, even to this day, for a lot of young people who are raised in communities and in religious traditions where, you know, homosexuality is considered anathema still, you know, there is an internalization and a self-loathing that develops because society is giving you the message that something is wrong with you.
Right. Something needs to be fixed.
Right.
You're not enough. You know, you're evil, as some religions would say. And then, you know, their little loophole of, you know, I love you, but I love the sinner, but I hate the sin. Well, if you love the quote-unquote sinner, fucking treat him better.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, I think this is one of the things I write about in this book that I wrote, Out in Time, you know, where I talk to three generations of men who are like now in their 60s and 70s that I call the Stonewall generation, men of my age who are in their 40s and 50s of the AIDS generation, and then young guys in their 20s, the queer generation. You know, it's very easy to feel like an other. Right. When you're raised in a, you know, predominantly heterosexual society. So even, you know, I talk in the book I dispel this idea that it's so easy to be a gay man nowadays because yes, there is marriage equality. Yes, there have definitely been advances. However, when at 3 or 4 or 5, you don't know those things. All you know is that there's something different about you. Mm-hmm. And so this othering that takes place very often turns into that loneliness and that desperation and that self-loathing that for many LGBTQ people predominates their lives.
What are some of the common unhealthy coping mechanisms that people reach for in the absence of support?
Well, we know that the LGBTQ population has higher levels of mental health distress than the general population, higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety. There is reliance on substances as a means of coping and ameliorating those feelings. There's a reliance on sex to combat those feelings too. These are quick fixes. Mm-hmm. So in the absence of being able to sort of manage those negative feelings about yourself, I understand, and I'm not going to judge, you know, the fact that people are turning to alcohol and other drugs or to sex to negate those feelings. Ultimately, we need better solutions. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is like normalize being a gay person in this society. Once you normalize that, all of these health issues sort of disappear.
Okay. Give us a history briefing. Describe the events, you know, paint a picture of what it looked like pre-Stonewall, what happened at Stonewall, what changed, and then the different era, the AIDS era,
yeah,
the queer generation, as you call it, and where we are today.
Let's do milestones. So we had this period in the 50s and 60s where there's some rumblings of, you know, gay life in New York City. I'm going to talk about New York City because I think that's the heart of it all. You know, the Mattachine Society meeting and having conversation about what it means to be gay. It's all very intellectual and also very hidden. But people are congregating. People want to socialize. People are social animals, right? So they want to be with others who are like them. You think about immigrant populations, for example. My parents, who are immigrants from Greece, lived in a neighborhood where they were all Greeks. You want to be with the people who are like you. So as a gay person, you're looking for people who are like you too. So in the 1950s and the 1960s, the little clubs, you know, appeared, sites and social venues where people could gather. The Stonewall Inn was one of these places in Greenwich Village. Now, the problem was that there were still laws on the books that had made homosexuality illegal. And so the police, depending on what political impetus there was, would raid these bars and these clubs.
And how would they define being homosexual? Just simply stating, I'm gay?
No.
Same-sex people kissing each other?
Touching each other, right?
Touching each other.
So you could enter...
To walk down the street holding hands, you could be arrested back then.
Well, you couldn't do that in the 1950s and 1960s. I mean, you can't even do that in some parts of the United States nowadays, right? But certainly when the police would raid those environments, they were looking for people touching each other. That was the ultimate sign that something was going on, right? It could have been perfect. It could have been two straight men hugging each other, but it appeared like it would be two gay men, and they would raid the bars. And so, you know, so move fast forward to 1969. It escalates, and the community is beginning to feel more empowered. And as a result of that, you have this rebellion, this riot that takes place in the summer of 1969, where people say, "Enough's enough." You know, a rebellion and a riot that's not led by just gay men and gay women, but by trans women and people of color, and you know, this very beautiful rainbow of individuals fighting against the police. You know, that went on for several days, and that's the beginning.
And talk about the brutality, because it from what I've read, it wasn't just, oh, we're going to arrest you for touching each other. The depth of the harassment and the humiliation.
Absolutely. I mean, people were beaten. They were beaten. They were verbally. Look, I mean, I think gay people.
You could lose your job.
Absolutely. You could lose your job. You could lose your job for being a gay person. You could lose your job for being a gay person nowadays still, right? We have the Equality Act that was passed by the House of Representatives recently. It's not going to pass the Senate, you know. We don't have to go wide into that. But, you know, it's like it's very easy to lose your livelihood even to this day. But certainly, in the 1950s and the 1960s, you know, prior to the Stonewall riots,
you had no recourse. No recourse.
You had absolutely no recourse. And you could be beaten physically. You could be beaten emotionally, you know, and you could lose everything that you had worked for. And so many people suppress their identities throughout the course of their lives and, you know, never were able to live the lives that they should have lived. Mm-hmm.
And so what happened at Stonewall?
So at Stonewall, we have the beginning of the rebellion, people saying no more. We're not going to do this anymore. And so that sparks, that catalyzes a movement in New York City, which spreads throughout the country. Certainly it was going on on the West Coast in California and San Francisco and LA also.
And did they fight the police?
They did fight the police. They threw things. They fought. They took control of the bar. They just refused to go. Mm-hmm. In a very similar way. Well, in a very similar way that the ACT UP, you know, which is a group that formed at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, fought the police and when they were demanding that, you know, the federal government pay attention to the epidemic. In fact, I actually think that the skills that the gay community gained from the Stonewall riot got transferred into, you know, the AIDS movement. So you have this movement, you have a social, you know, like with everything else, like there's a climate change, there is a political shift, there is a shift in the landscape that takes place. And, you know, over the course of the next few years, by 1973, 1974, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association dispel the idea that homosexuality is this abnormality, the psychopathology, and you begin to have a normalization of what it means to be an LGBT person, to be a gay person. Okay, so now things are looking up good here, right? Because gay bars are appearing, people aren't getting arrested, people get to hold hands walking down the street, maybe not so much in Arkansas, but certainly in San Francisco and in New York City, they're getting to do that in L.A., and then it's 1981, and all of a sudden this like viral pathogen hits and the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And so now, here's a movement that has helped advance the well-being of this population. This disease comes and in some ways manifests all of the negative feelings society has about gay people as weak, as sick. And in fact, here's this disease that's making people weak and sick. You know, the wrath of God, you know, mm-hmm. for having all this sex. And in fact, in this editorial that I talked about earlier, I wrote that there's no clear evidence. You know, some people would argue that it's the sexual promiscuity of the 1970s that allowed AIDS to happen. There's no evidence that that's really true. In fact, we know that that AIDS has probably existed in our bloodstream since the 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, I read that. I read something about that.
It's been there, right? And so it was ready to happen at some mm-hmm. point in time. And so it was not necessarily, you know, the sexual liberation of the 70s that allowed it to happen. But, you know, you have the 1980s and you have this like enormous death, which is devastating. And for me, as a young gay man growing up in New York City with all the promise of Stonewall, right? Mm-hmm. And all the promise of being able to love openly and freely, that just shifted everything in the 1980s. I actually think what it also did, what actually had a beneficial effect, if Stonewall said to American society, we're here and you're not going to arrest us, what the AIDS crisis did was say, you have to take care of us.
Right.
Right. You have to pay attention to us.
It's more than just passive freedom.
Right.
You have to actively.
Right. We are members of this society, which I then think brings us into the 2000s where like we have need to have the same rights as everybody else, which means that we get to marry who we love.
Yes.
We get to get our husbands or our wives' social security benefits. And I think that these course of like marriage equality happens because you have AIDS and the reaction to AIDS, and AIDS happens because you have the Stonewall riots. And without these events over the course of the last 50 years, some of which were very devastating, and I would never say that the AIDS crisis was not a horrible time for the gay community. It absolutely was, and it continues to be. But at the same time, let's flip it on its head and say that it was also demonstrated how powerful and resilient mm-hmm. the population was.
And I think how it drew out the people in the country who were non-judgmental and who said, you know, we want to be a part of this movement. We may not identify as gay, but, right. you know, you are every bit as much of our brothers and sisters as hetero
right.
People are.
Right. And like, look, I mean, you look at all of the polling over the course of the last 50 years about, you know, people, you know, accepting, you know, I'm not going to say gay lifestyle. I hate that term, lifestyle. Accepting gay people for who they are, and the numbers just continue to increase over time. Mm-hmm. And certainly among millennials, mm-hmm. right? This is not an issue, right? Yeah. For millennials whose gender and their sexuality is so fluid in a way that's probably very different from our generation, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like this, the thought that you would reject somebody because of who they love is just unbelievable to them.
I also think MTV played a big part in helping normalize people that weren't, you know, binary or hetero.
Well, the 80s did that, right? So we had that. Yeah. Remember, we had all of that gender bending stuff of the 1980s, right? Yeah. A term that we probably didn't use in the 1980s, gender bending, but we're right. using it now, of like Boy George, right? Yeah. You know, Culture Club, that whole thing, Adamant, that whole new
Annie
wave
Lennox.
Movement. Annie yeah. Lennox, right? So this gets back to my point of earlier. It's about normalization. Mm-hmm. It's about saying, hey, this is it, and not reacting. The story I always tell about my parents and coming out. Oh, actually, I'm not going to tell you that story. The story I'm going to tell you is about my friend, my best friend, George, to whom the book is dedicated. Mm-hmm. And he is somebody I've known for 52 years. We've known each other since we've been 4 years old. And when I was 18, I was during high school, it was 1977 to 1981, I chose to be in the closet. And I wanted to go to prom, and I wanted to have a girlfriend, and I wanted to do all those things, right? Mm-hmm. But I knew I was a gay man. As soon as I went to college at Columbia, I came out. And I, you know, started having sex with men. And, you know, it was complicated for me because even though I was across the river from Queens in Manhattan at Columbia University, you know, the whole community had gotten wind of the fact that here was this young man who was gay. And I remember getting off the subway one day, you know, probably in the end of my freshman year, the first term of my freshman year at Columbia, and seeing my friend George as I was going back to Queens. And I said to him, you know, George, hey, you know, you probably heard, blah, 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 I'm gay. Something to that effect. And his reaction to me was like, hey, look, I'm going to see the Mets on Saturday. You want to come with me? That's what I mean by normalization, right? He didn't make a big deal about it. He didn't say, oh, let's talk about it. He just said, let's go to the baseball game together. Right. And that, when we get to that point in society where everybody can react that way, the pain and the otherness and the loneliness and the depression are going to be wiped away.
It should be like saying, by the way, my favorite color is orange.
Right.
Oh, cool.
Right. My hair is brown. Right. Exactly. But we're not there. We're certainly not there. Right. We can't even deal. Like, I mean, come on. We live in a society that can't even deal with the fact that we have like a royal that's like one quarter African American. Right. You know, right. That's a huge deal.
Yeah. In the process of doing this podcast over the last 8 years, I have been confronted with the fact that I had a lot of blind spots in what I knew about the LGBTQ community, especially the trans community. Mm-hmm. When I started doing the podcast, I didn't even know that shemale was a derogatory term. You know, it was embarrassing. But, you know, thankfully the listeners have educated me and enlightened me gently and lovingly along the way. And I think you would probably agree that that's the way to do it is to not shame somebody for not knowing, but to say, hey, let's all enjoy this movement towards the future and help.
Yes.
Educate each other.
I would completely agree with that. And I will tell you that, you know, again, as a 56-year-old, right, I joke with my students and in my research lab, I'm like, you know, in the 80s, we just had like, you know, gay and straight. I could barely deal with that, right? But it is a completely different, we're in a completely different place. I feel that I continue to learn and grow because, you know, my students teach me. right? Mm-hmm. How to think about issues of gender being on a spectrum and sexual right. identity being on a spectrum in a way that I never thought about, you know, 30 right. years ago.
And it, at first, I think the inclination is for people that don't, who aren't particularly empathetic, is to think, oh, well, now it's a fad and everybody just, and the moment I found myself thinking that, I thought, no, people have felt this way forever.
Right.
They're just now feeling comfortable enough to be able to say, I don't really identify as male or female. And I don't have a word for what it is.
Right.
And I don't need to have a word for what it is.
Right.
I just know how I like to dress. And maybe some days I want to be referred to as he, and then another day I want to be referred to as she.
And it's safer than it was, right? In a way, in a similar way, this is a parallel story. Like, you know, when I went to Rutgers a couple of years ago and I was recruited to be the dean there, you know, the newspaper and this newspapers and the local press there made a very big deal about me, an openly gay man, becoming the dean. And it's not like other individuals who had been gay before had not been deans, but I led with being gay, and right. And, you know, that might not seem like
no,
a huge
Perry,
deal.
Nobody gay had ever been in a position of power anywhere.
Right. But I could be there and say, I am a gay man. And this is and this and I study, you know, gay men's health. Right. And by the way, I can be a dean. Right. And that was a huge deal. And I think it's those little steps, you know, that move us forward. And
what do you think they had misgivings about?
Who?
Just that they didn't know. The unknown, is that what they fear? That you're going to have an agenda?
Perhaps. I actually think it's that human beings just tend to be afraid of things that are different than they are, right?
Yeah.
And so, and it relates back to the immigrant story I said before. Like, you know, immigrants tend to move in with other immigrants because it feels safe. I think, you know, if you see somebody who is a different color than you, or is a different race than you, or is a different, you know, height than you, and it's different from you, it threatens your you and who you are.
And is that a genetic thing, do you think, that's going on?
I think that there probably is some biological mechanism for that, for sure, like everything else. Like, you know, I believe homosexuality and gay identity is everything. Like, if my hair color is genetic, certainly my sexual orientation is genetic. But I think it's reinforced by society.
But, I mean, the fear of otherness.
Yeah, I think there probably is. And I think that's society. Look, I think human beings we are born into this world with these biological predispositions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, to what extent does our society and our culture and our family reinforce them? You know, for me, I fortunately had the parents who were like, didn't believe in the othering, right? But for many people, they do.
They were supportive when you came out?
They were supportive. My parents were amazing when I came out. They were just like, people are like, oh, you were so lucky. I'm like, no, they just did their job.
Right.
They just loved their son. And
right.
That's all that really mattered.
He's such a nice person. He didn't murder me.
Right. Exactly. Yes. They just love, like, that's what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to say,
right.
Hey, we love you. Right.
But that's how low the bar was, that, you know, to be,
right.
to not disown somebody, you know, we're going to give you a trophy.
Yeah. And you know what's really fascinating to me about the whole thing, though, is like my story in 1981 coming out, you know, doesn't sound so different from the story for somebody coming out in 1951, and certainly doesn't sound different from the story of my cousin's son who came out to me and my husband a few years ago, who, for all intents and purposes, should have had an easy process, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was there. Everybody was at our wedding. Everybody loved us. No problem. We love Perry. We love Bobby. All is good, right? But James struggled with it also, which was the impetus ultimately for this book, to say that, look, there are definitely advances in our society, but that psychological process is consistent.
Of course. I get nervous saying, honey, I don't want to go to the restaurant that you like. I couldn't imagine what it would be like, you know, even to saying that people who were liberal saying something like that, because even if they were accepting, there might still be awkwardness. There might be patronizing chatter, you know, to share some things that somebody who isn't LGBTQ doesn't know
well, the point I come back to over and over and over again, which is what most straight people don't realize, is that as a gay person, you, or as a lesbian, or as a trans person, you spend your whole life coming out. The idea that you just come out once is nonsense, mm-hmm. right? You're spending your whole life telling people who you are. So there's a great scene in the movie Love, Simon, which is based on the young adult novel Simon and the Homo Sapiens, where Simon, the characters in the movie, are coming out to their parents as straight. And so I challenge any straight person to imagine a life where they, everywhere they go, they have to say, oh, by the way, I'm straight.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's rough. When I got to Rutgers, I lived it again at like 54 years old all of a sudden, because people didn't know I was a gay man. And I fortunately at 54 had the skills that I didn't have to announce it. I would just say, oh yeah, now I'm going to dinner with my husband, and just assume that that gave the message about who I was.
Would there be a moment of tension in your body?
There still is a moment of tension. You know, when I experience it the most, when I'm not, where I feel like I'm not in safe environments, right? So when we went to Russia, when I turned 50 years old, where I was very conscious of the fact that we were walking down the street as gay men, and, you know, people were like looking at us, you know. So there is still that feeling like I'm going to be found out, right? And people are going to laugh at me, and they're going to make fun of me, and they're going to, you know, and talk about me. And that was always the thing that was painful to me, which is like the thought that people were talking about me, about something that shouldn't have mattered, that mm-hmm. something that should have been like my eye color, right? It's that never really goes away, that feeling. And so, you know, It's real and it's deep, and it never goes away for the rest of your life, right? And it's just always going to be there. And you're constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop and to be rejected somehow because of who you are, right?
Have there been moments where you were anticipating that and then you were met with an ideal response?
Well, my parents certainly was, you know, an ideal response. I remember when I told my father that I was gay at 18 years old. I was, you know, again at Columbia that year, and at that point, and came home and told him. And his response to me, "Was I sure?" And I said, "I thought so." I said, mm-hmm. "I've had sex with women. I've had sex with men. I'm pretty sure I like having sex with men." Mm-hmm. And his response was, "Can you live that way?" Which was an interesting response. And I said, "Well, Dad, I have no choice on this."
I love how dads make things practical.
Yeah, can you live this way, right? I'm like, "Yeah, Dad, I have no choice," right? And he's like, "Okay." And then his next comment was, "Well, you have to tell your mother because I have no secrets from her," right? And so that was great, actually. So, the other thing is, I come back to the Rutgers example. You know, I was at NYU for 20 years. I feel this is true. And maybe it's not, but maybe it's my just perception. I felt like I couldn't go any higher in that institution because I was a gay man, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I got to Rutgers, and the fact that I was a gay man didn't stop me from being a dean, right? And probably is not going to stop me from growing even more at that institution. That is, to me, a sign of an enlightened environment. So that surprised me. Yeah, it did surprise me.
That's got to feel nice, huh?
It feels pretty great, and it makes me want to just do more and more for that university. Nice.
I would like to go back to the early 80s.
Yes.
Paint some vignettes, the human, emotional aspect of...
Well, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories in relation to that, because, you know...
I'm just going to adjust your mic one more time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just tilt it towards you a little bit.
So I remember, you know, in the New York, you know, for many of us, the first time we heard about this was, you know, we saw things around us, but, you know, nobody knew what was going on. But certainly I remember in the New York Times a story appearing that summer, I think of 1981, about this rare cancer that was in gay men. And I just thought, well, that's really, really odd, you know. And, you know, and I remember because I was at the beach reading the Times at that point. I was actually on Fire Island, and I just thought, what is this thing? And, you know, it kind of gave me pause, but then I didn't think about it. You know, it was incredibly, I feel like the 80s and up to 1996 were defined by just this low-grade panic. you know, that permeated through my body. And I experienced a lot of loss. My partner, who I was with for 6 years, died in 1994. He died in my arms. You know, that trauma I live with to this day. You know, there was a period in my life where, like, 1 year after the, you know, year after year after year, I was losing people in my life, right? And so for me, you know, what was difficult was to see a community that appeared when I first was coming out, you know, in the late 1970s, early 1980s, incredibly vibrant, all of a sudden just sort of like be decimated, you know, and, you know, the fear that was taking hold.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen Fran Lebowitz's, the documentary about her? She talks about how it decimated the artistic community.
I think that, you know, it, you know, I saw what it did to the artistic community. I saw what it did. I have this tattoo on my arm here, which is like, you know, these five stars, which are the five people who I've lost in my life to the epidemic, like five really close people to my life. You know, it's just like it altered my life forever, right? Where I am at this point in my life and what I've chosen to do with my life is defined so much by the loss that I experienced as a young man in my life. And nobody should have to go through that. I remember talking to my therapist at that point, and she said to me, no, Perry, it's not natural. It's not natural that as a 25-year-old or a 27-year-old, you're experiencing this loss. So there was this panic. There was this fear. Nobody knew what was going on. We didn't really know till 1985 that it was a virus. Mm-hmm. It could have been this thing called inhalant nitrates or poppers, you know. Mm-hmm. It could have been drugs. It could have been because you had a million partners. But in fact, what do we know now? All it takes is one partner, right?
Right.
And, you know, this was the confusion was what was causing the great anxiety and also the inability to know what was going to happen. And I think once the virus was detected and once the test was available, despite the fact that people continue to die and heightened the highest levels of death were in 1993, 1994, you knew that there was going to be an end in sight once the virus was detected, right? Because you knew somebody was going to find a way to contain this thing, right? But for a while there, when you didn't know, it's like, imagine you're in a dark, 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 dark room, right? And you're like, you know, your eyes haven't adjusted yet, and you're trying to feel your way around. That's kind of what it felt like to me in the 1980s, mm-hmm. that sort of like walking in this like dark space, in this dream state, with a low level of anxiety constantly running through my body.
Wow.
Yeah. And I, you know, there are times where I feel it now where I'll dream of something or I'll think of something, or even as I was writing the book where I relive it. The last book I wrote, which was about 15 men who survived the crisis and are now adults in their 50s and 60s, it was the most cathartic experience I've ever had in my life. You know, as I was writing their stories, I just, you know, was reliving all of the loss I experienced, and it was just the crying that went on, right? I think I spent more time crying than actually writing that book.
What was it like back then when you would get a cold?
What is it like now when I get a cold? You know, it's
you still feel that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you can't escape that.
And thankfully, we have people that aren't that familiar with this because, you know, it hasn't spiraled like it, you know, it did in the 90s, and there are better meds now. But
sure.
For those that don't know, it would the HIV virus would attack your immune system, and the first thing that people would feel would be flu-like symptoms,
right.
Correct?
Right. So immediately after, now we know that immediately after someone is infected, within a 2 or 3 week period of time, people tend to develop this huge flu-like reaction, which actually turns out, based on the research, is a good thing. If you have a huge acute reaction, your body's fighting it, and you're actually developing, you know, the ability to like go on. And it seems, and some great biologist is going to actually show this, a virologist is going to show that people who had that acute reaction actually, I think, had a higher likelihood of surviving. But you know, when you're coming of age in an environment where, you know, every cold, every cut, everything is devastating. As an adult, even in the presence of all these advances, you know, you see a bump on your arm and you get in panic because it's like it's a learned reaction, right? Yeah. I mean, the fact of the matter is, and this is really important for the audience to know also, is like we have 40 to 50,000 new infections a year still in this country. This disease is not gone. There are 1.2 million people living with HIV in this country, right? We know that if you are a black gay man, the chances are 1 in 2 that by age 50, you will be HIV positive.
Really?
It's, yes. There's a huge disparity, right? So the majority of infections in this country continue to exist in the gay population and then in women. And then in the gay population and women, the African-American segment of those populations, most devastated. 1 in 2. If it goes unchecked, we'll be positive by HIV.
And is that because of lack of access to healthcare?
Yeah. So, like, I spent a lot of my time in my research thinking about, you know, how social conditions and politics and policies and discrimination fuel health disparities, right? So I've said over and over again that HIV is as much a viral condition as it is a social condition. If it was just a viral condition, it would be an equal opportunity destroyer, but it's not. It attacks populations that are most marginalized. So for the African-American population, it is a variety of things. So black gay men are discriminated because they're black and because they're gay, and they often don't have access to the same way that white folks do. And what we have shown in our research and others have shown in their research is not black gay men aren't having more sex or more random sex or more sex partners. But what they are doing, gay men, is that they're choosing partners based on race. And in the black community, the virus is not as well contained. And as a result, the likelihood of getting infection is greater. And so those are pretty bad numbers, you know, that in, you know, 2019, we still have 40,000 infections when in fact we know that an HIV positive person who is on treatment and is taking their medications cannot transmit the virus. Undetectable equals untransmittable. Amazing. And we know that we can, there's a one medication, Truvada, which is used in the form of pre-exposure prophylaxis that a negative person can take like a birth control pill, right? And not get infected if they take their pill every day. The tools are there, right? Yeah. So if the tools are there, what's wrong? Well, to me, that means it's about social conditions. And so, you know, not to get too political here, but I'm going to get political. You know, when you have a president who says, well, I'm going to bring in AIDS by 2030, you know, by putting all these meds out there, and at the same time continues to chip away at the rights of LGBT people, well, you're not going to bring an end to AIDS because you're deteriorating the social and emotional well-being of the population. And that's what's fueling the epidemic.
Yeah. And I think any administration, and I'm going to get political here for a second, both sides of the aisle, you know, we spend all our money on the defense budget and this and that and fighting wars. And it's like, you know,
let's give people health care.
Yeah. the wars are supposed to keep us safe. Right. And well, health care would be a nice way to keep people safe.
Yeah. But it would actually be a nice human rights thing to do that, to actually just give people the health care that they actually deserve. I actually think that, you know, yeah, I mean, if people don't have to worry about that, you know, how they're going to pay for their medications. You know, I mean, I think it's huge, right? But it's not where we're spending our money.
As somebody who studies psychology and public health, I know you probably don't have an answer to this. I don't think anybody does. But what do you find yourself thinking when you see another mass shooting?
I think that it is a public health crisis. I think that it is an indication of undiagnosed and untreated psychopathology in our society. It shows me that we continue to treat mental health as separate from health. Mm-hmm. In fact, where it is just health, and we don't attend as much to those issues as we do to the physical issues. And so we need to do that, right?
Yes.
We need to treat the depression. We need to treat the PTSD. We need to treat all of those things. And we're not. And we just say, oh, it's mental health. It's not really a health issue, right? I actually think the medical profession is partially responsible for that, you know, that sort of poo-pooing of mental health issues. So that's what I think. And I think that if you want to solve, do I think that taking all the guns off the street is going to solve the problems? Well, it's kind of like saying, do I think that just having all the meds out there in the world is going to solve the AIDS crisis? No, you need to fight the underlying cause. And the underlying cause are social conditions and emotional conditions that fuel these health problems. That's how you deal with it. The rest are Band-Aids.
Yeah, and I think teaching kids how to identify and express their emotions would be a great thing. I can't imagine there are many shooters out there that had a lot of deep human connections and vulnerable relationships in their and their life. No, I don't know.
I doubt that. And I think that, you know, you want to hope that, you know, we could do that kind of work in our schools, but our schools are so worried about math and reading that they don't think about this. So I think schools are places where we need to do social development and social education. That's what they should be about. And they'll learn how to read and they'll learn how to write and all of this stuff. But we're so caught up on those mechanics that we forget that there's this child there that needs to learn how to be part of society.
And you know where I think the danger is? It is because there's nuance in teaching and there's ethics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's going to vary from state to state of Absolutely. What people think is appropriate. Right. You know, math, there's not, you know, a sissy way of teaching math.
Right.
But I can't imagine the discussions that are being had right now in towns where they do want to begin talking about identifying emotions and setting boundaries and saying, you know, it's okay to cry. And
what we're seeing, and we see it in places like New York and in LA and San Francisco and Chicago and other big cities where there is that. I mean, this is why you then have this schism in the society, right? In our society, because you have other places in the country where that conversation is not happening at all. And it comes, you know, and it's like men are not supposed to have feelings, right? They're supposed to be butch and masculine and contain everything.
How's
right?
that working out?
That's not working out so well at all, you know, for gay men or straight men.
Did not work out for me for 40 years. I almost drank myself to death.
Well, hyper masculinity is toxic masculinity. Call it whatever you want. You know, it is like this notion that, you know, you've got to be this hunter gatherer. And if you're not this like butch resolved, totally confident man, that there's something wrong with you.
And also the feeling that they're mutually exclusive. You know, I play hockey, I build furniture, and I cry in people's arms.
Exactly.
And I think they're all what makes a man.
Well, because we want things to live in boxes, right? Because it's easier that way. A man acts this way, a woman acts that way, and so therefore you can't, what do you mean? And this is why, let's get back to the millennials. This is why the blending is so fascinating right now. Like, look, you know, I cry, right? And I'm like this big guy, right? I'm like this big guy with a beard and everything, right? With tattoos on his arms, but I cry, right? And I think that's hot. That's what guys are supposed to do, right? Those are the guys that I want to hang around with, right? And I had the great, 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 great fortune for several years of working on a committee at the American Psychological Association where we wrote this really cool report about, you know, the health of boys and men. And, you know, and we really focused on racial and ethnic minority boys and men and sexual minority boys and men and really put the literature out there to say, like, social conditions and this toxic masculinity, if we don't deal away with it, the health of these populations is going to continue to get worse and worse and worse. And so we've got to push those boundaries, right?
And so what would you like to see? Let's say you had $100 billion budget and you were the secretary of health, education, and welfare.
I would work with parents to teach them how to like love their children and how to have their children express their feelings. Obama said it, you know, when in the first ever AIDS plan we had for our country, which was, by the way, for your audience, in 2010, we had an epidemic for 30 years, but not a national AIDS plan. And then we had one. And one of the things that is in that plan is this very clear statement that we want to have fathers learn how to love their gay sons, right? And that's huge, that statement, right? And so I don't care if it's their gay sons or it's their straight sons. I want parents to be able to help their children be able to express their emotion and express love, right? And not just be this mechanical robots, right? And we're far from that, right? And we're far from it partially because, you know, some cultural context, that's not appropriate, you know, for boys to act this way. And so we've got a way to go. But I think, again, one of the great things in our society, I think also, and this, I write about this in the book also, is that art always leads the way, right? Mm-hmm. It really does. Whether it's painting or if it's music or if it's like film, it's always ahead of the curve. And then we, the researchers and everybody, catch on later, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the more and more you have depictions, This is, you know, depictions of like being a man who is kind and emotional and loving. The more you normalize that, the more it's likely that parents will raise their sons to be that way.
Right. That doesn't mean he's going to be a doormat.
He's not going to be a doormat. Or he may be gay or may not be gay, but who cares, right? Mm-hmm. And he's not going to be a sissy. And he's, you know, he can still be this super successful, whatever that means in somebody's life, you know, person who hasn't, probably have a really good relationship with a woman or a man or anybody mm-hmm. else, right? And, you know, and it's not going to be a failure, and that's going to be like a dish rag, right? But that's what we're fighting against is like sissy, wimpy, you know, you can't act that way. You're not supposed to cry. I was so fortunate I had a father who cried, like, you know, and mm-hmm. maybe it's because he was a Greek man, he cried, because, you know, Greeks just cry, right? But it was like, it was, that modeling was incredibly helpful. Yeah. I can't imagine not crying, right? I compare it to my – so I have a very Irish Catholic husband, right, mm-hmm. you know, who does not cry, right? Mm-hmm. Right? And he just looks at me sometimes and says, you know, he doesn't cry, right? He doesn't cry. He doesn't cry. Trust me. He yes. looks at me and says, like, what's wrong with you? When I'm like watching a film that some or something yes. or some stupid Hallmark Christmas movie, right? And mm-hmm. I start to cry. But I find it freeing.
It's incredibly, incredibly freeing, but it's really scary in the beginning when you first start allowing yourself to do it. Because I have found underneath that sadness is often a tremendous amount of anger,
yeah,
disappointment, yeah. confusion.
Yeah. Yeah, the things that you feel like, you know, I didn't do, I should have done it different, I should have been, yeah. I mean, I think also that's, I'm going to relate it back to the whole coming out thing. I think it's like, it's that scariness of like, because it opens everything up for you, mm-hmm. right? When you're like, you're testing the waters, right?
And you don't know if you're going to be judged for it. You don't know, is my anger a bottomless pit? Am I going to lose control of myself? What's this new experience of... Right. Falling apart.
I actually think that the releasing of the emotions, the releasing of the feelings is actually chips away at that anger, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But then you can end up just crying for the next 10 years, right?
Maybe that's what was needed.
Yeah, I think it's okay. I totally support that. I think it's totally fine.
Yeah. I heard somebody say one time, and I can't remember who it was, but they said, it's easier to hate than to hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, wow, that is so... It's so true. It's so true. And that's what's modeled in our movies is to hurt somebody, you know, or to hate somebody rather than to feel hurt.
Right. Because you can't be vulnerable. Right. And that it is that vulnerability ultimately. And this is why I think relationships fail too. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think this, like, I've started studying, you know, relationships between men and, you know, the dynamics there. And it's like, you know, the inability to be vulnerable, you know, I don't care if you're a man or a woman, a man or a man or whatever you are, like what combination. It's like, if you're not willing to put it out there and say like, I trust this person and I'm going to be vulnerable and I'm going to expose myself and I don't care that like I look like crap in the morning and like, mm-hmm. you know, and that I've got these flaws, it's not going to work. Right. Because if you keep it compartmentalized, and this is where I think a lot of things, that's where the relationship falls apart.
Right.
Right. Right. The ability to actually say, you know, here's who I am. And, you know, and there's parts of me that are really great and there are parts of me that are really crappy. Right.
And when that person loves that part of you, it's the most amazing feeling.
I will be married 10 years in August, which is like shocking to me. Right. Because mm-hmm. one, I'm a gay man. I shouldn't have been like whoever knew I was going to be married. Right. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, after a series, after my first partner died, had this like series of like horrific relationships, mostly because, you know, I was unresolved about his death, mm-hmm. right? Duh, right? But when I was able to finally open up to a person and just be myself, yeah, it worked. It absolutely worked, right? And the person who said to me, you know, I don't care that you're Perry Halkidis well with all these degrees. Like, I just like the messy you, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it magical.
Yeah, the awesome thing when we claim our authenticity is we get to see how that other person shows up. We get a chance for them to reveal their character. And so we have great information regardless whether it's they can't show up for me. Great. Then I'm going to move on. I've got that information now. Or they can. My partner's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a win-win when we claim our authenticity and we, you know.
Well, I think this is why the other piece of, it's interesting that we're having this conversation about relationships. It's like, that's why I think when trust is broken, mm-hmm. I think that people meet in this space where they can be authentic and they can be vulnerable and it works. And the minute you break the trust, it's really, really hard to, it's really just too hard to repair that.
You know, I think it depends on what the trust was that was broken. Yeah. And, you know, I had a therapist say to me how people come together, how they repair their relationship, much like how a tree heals itself after, you know, yeah. it gets bent in the wind.
Yeah.
You know, it can be stronger than ever. And Absolutely. Ultimately, you know, she said that's what builds a relationship are those little tears, repairing right. those little tears and making sure that it's being tended, mm-hmm. tended to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, intimacy yeah. without trust, you couldn't have it. You couldn't have it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is something that gay men grapple with, right? I think they grapple with the ability to be intimate with others. I think it's a huge challenge for many gay men. I think it's because, you know, we're not socialized to have relationships with another man, right? Nobody told me what it was like to have a relationship with a man, right? And, you know, and we go back to this whole masculinity thing. So you're in this, so they're in a relationship with this other person who has to be like alpha dog and like, who does what, right? When you finally find that person, say, you know what? You know, I'll do this and you'll do that and that's okay. And sometimes I'm going to do things that are more on the feminine spectrum and sometimes I'm going to do things that are more on them. That's when it really, really works. But that's a really hard lesson. And it's a really hard lesson for a young gay man to try to figure out. Right. And so I didn't figure it out till I was 45.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to share? Give me the name of your book again.
The book is called Out in Time. It's actually a play on the words, and it, you know, the subtitle of it is The Public Lives of Gay Men from Stonewall to the Queer Generation. It's published by Amazon. Out in Time, sort of like in the and I will take no credit for this. I will give credit to my husband Bobby for this title. Like mm-hmm. on a car ride one day, as we were talking about this book, he said, "No, Out in Time, like you know." Each of these men came out in a different time, but people also come out when it's their time. And that's mm-hmm. really what this book is about the stories of individuals coming out. You know, I think that, look, I think what the last thing I'd have to say is that, you know, I come back to my graduation speech from a couple of weeks ago. Health is tied intimately with politics. Right. And like for us to make believe that it's not is foolish. And so that if we want the health of our population to get better, we have to like demonstrate and demand that these things get better. And so I have great hope for the millennials because they are going to fight for these things.
I do have a lot of hope, too. Mm-hmm. There's some real, in a good way, badasses out there.
They're so thoughtful. Like these interviews that I did with these 15 guys. You know, the Stonewall guys were great, right? Because they mm-hmm. had the cool stories about being arrested and like mm-hmm. the love letters from the 50s, which were like really, really amazing. Like, you know, Wilson, one of the guys who was a black man who grew up in Baltimore, brought me like two volumes of his like love letters from his boyfriend. And that was really, really cool, right? And then the guys of my generation, you know, they're still dealing with like all the crap from the AIDS epidemic. We're still like reeling from that, right? Mm-hmm. But the young guys, their nuanced understanding of place in the world, their understanding of like, you know, we're going to debunk this archetype of the white gay man and we're going to make it something else. What it means to be a gay man was so sophisticated
yeah.
and so smart that, I learned a ton from them. So I have enormous, enormous, enormous hope.
And then there's also the side that is a little depressing because you're like, oh, I guess I'm becoming a little bit the old guy that misses things.
I miss things all the time. And, you know, and this is why my great benefit in my life is being surrounded by these students who are in their 20s who are pushing me and keeping me fresh and keeping me relevant.
That's so awesome that you aren't threatened by that. Once again, a great quality in a man is to not be threatened by, someone else's intelligence or power.
No, I think it's one. I will say that I think that, you know, one of the things I say to my students, one of the things I say to my faculty at my school and my staff is like, you know what? We're going to try things and some things will work and some things won't. And if they don't work, big deal. And I actually think that lesson comes to me, yes, because I had these great parents who taught me to take risks, right? But also in light of what happened in the 80s and the early 90s and what I saw, whatever.
What a great note to end on. Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What a great guy. And I love when I get into a conversation with another man about masculinity, what it is to be a man, and because I feel like it's just such a cancer in our culture, the idea of what genders are supposed to be. This is the only survey I'm doing at the, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. Gracie's come in with a note from the king. What word bring you? What are you all excited about? I love that sound when she comes running into the room I'm in, and it's just, I just hear her little feet pounding on the floor. Oh, we're coming up on my lap now. All right. Gracie's gonna help me read the final. Can you hear her? We just went for a little skate. This is a happy moment, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Awkward Moment, and she writes, I've always associated the past with pain. I remember living in dread of my father's anger. I remember loneliness. I remember feeling wrong. This wrongness festered in me when I watched my little brother die of a sudden illness. It formed the razor I used to try to quiet the pain. It formed the hatred I felt when I stood on the scale after eating a dinner of burnt broccoli. Many years later, I'm in a better place. The scars on my arm are faded, and I've traded starving for better coping skills. My depression is still there, but I don't let it control everything about me. I go to therapy, take meds, and have friends I love who I can ask for help. I've moved to a city I love and choose to do things I love. Last night, I was sitting outside. It was a beautiful and calm evening. I sat listening to the wind, my roommate's grumpy bulldog snuggled up next to me. The sound of the train in the distance was peaceful. It was almost like a memory. It made me think of beautiful things. I remembered my brother's laughter and his smile. I remembered the smell of the campfire and the sound of girls singing at the camp I worked at for many years. I remembered the happiness I felt the first time I realized I had friends who accepted me and understood my darkness. So many of us have painful pasts and painful memories. I know I'm not alone in this, but in that moment, I realized, in that moment, I realized there was love there too. It isn't easy, but I hope I can remember that. So many of us have painful pasts and painful memories. Gracie. So many of us have painful pasts and painful memories. I know I'm not alone in this, but in that moment I realized there was love there too. It isn't easy, but I hope I can remember that when things are hard. Thank you so much for that. I love when I come across a survey that's just the perfect tone to end the show on. And I love Gracie. I don't know if you can hear her. She's just sitting here in my lap. She has been such a great addition to my life. And I think I have been for hers, too. I think she'd like me to get another dog, though. She's read all the books that I've given her. And she's read, actually, a lot of them twice. That's the other thing. When I'm depressed, I cannot tell if what I'm saying is funny or not. I second guess myself. It's exhausting. It's exhausting. But as I said before, I know I will come out the other side. It might be tomorrow. It might be next week. It might be next month. But, and anybody else is feeling that way, be kind to yourself. You know, I try to treat when my depression comes crawling in, or in the fall when it comes parachuting in, I try to look at it like the flu. I wouldn't beat myself up for having the flu, so why should I talk badly to myself when it robs me of energy and passion and et cetera, et cetera? So if you're out there and you're struggling, be nice to yourself. Be nice to yourself. We're uniquely positioned to be our own best friends, and yet we talk to ourselves meaner than our worst enemies. So that's my two cents. And just never forget that you're not alone. And thanks for listening. Thank you.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely
beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.